this one up.
Thank you, Ian. The implementation issues are about presentation of contracts and the statement of financial position of an entity. The first issue is about presentation of a contract that contains multiple performance obligations. Stakeholders have questioned whether an entity could have a contract asset and a contract liability for a single contract, or should the position be determined on a net basis. Some stakeholders initially have an impression that the performance obligation rather than the contract is the level at which contract assets and contract liabilities are presented. However, other stakeholders think that the guidance in the standard along with the explanations in the basis for conclusions is clear, and the standard requires an entity to net each contract to either a contract asset or a contract liability, but not both. Further, any receivable is extracted from the contract position and presented separately. The second issue is about presentation of contracts that are combined and accounted for as a single contract. Some stakeholders think that the presentation guidance is unclear about whether the contract positions of these combined contracts should be presented on a net basis as a single contract or separately for each contract. One view is that following the guidance in the standard, an entity would come to a conclusion that the rights and obligations in the individual contracts are interdependent and hence best reflected by presenting the net position of the combined contracts as a single contract. Another view is that the individual contracts in the combined contract are presented separately. However, to reflect the amounts due from or to the individual counterparty, an entity needs to make adjustments because the transaction price would be allocated across performance obligations in the combined contract. The third issue is about offsetting contract positions with other items in the statement of financial position, or offsetting one contract position with another contract position. The new revenue standard does not provide guidance about offsetting of those balances, and there is presentation guidance in other standards that will enable entities to determine the appropriate offsetting. So over to the members for comments.
Okay, thank you, Raghavan. Now, contrary to my position in the previous paper, I'm happy to take comments on any three of the issues rather than breaking them up into three separate groups this time. So anybody in London got any comments on this paper and the three issues involved? Let's have a slow start. Brian.
Just to kick us off, it seems to me that at the level of the standard is fairly clear that the contract is the unit of account. These presentation questions, so on issue one, I would have a net contract position. On issue two, I would look to contract combination guidance to tell me what the contract was, and that would be my unit of account. And on issue three, I would look to the offsetting guidance under IFRS in IS1 and elsewhere to help me decide what to do. These are not questions that I've been receiving a lot of pushback on a day-to-day basis. There are companies with long-term contracting businesses where there are lots of things going on. People are paying subcontractors in advance, and there are advance payments or deferred payments where there are some issues to work through to work out exactly where things go in the balance sheet. But these basic questions seem straightforward at the moment.
Thank you. Mike.
So I fully agree with Brian, but I would like to add that it's really useful to make it clear how the mechanics actually work and how they are intended to work. So if you have a contract with multiple performance obligations and there is an allocation of the transaction price, and the additional complexity is that maybe each performance obligation has its own invoicing, so the entity might be issuing invoices, the invoices become due, amounts are received at that level, then the question does arise on mechanically what is the sequence and what are the steps that are required here. And I agree that at the end of the day it's going to be at the level of the contract, but one must first assess those individual contract assets and contract liabilities at the level of performance obligations, sum them up to the contract level, then pull out the receivable, because that isn't a different standard, that's a different quality. And then whatever remains as a contract asset or contract liability is offset. And then what could then remain is either a contract asset or a contract liability. So as stated here in paragraph 8, the result in such a scenario could be that there is a receivable and a contract asset, or a receivable and a contract liability.
Yeah, in a sense, the questions I get start where this paper finishes, because they're precisely those the questions about those mechanics.
Okay. Yes, on issue 2, I also agree that it's the contract. But on issue 3, if there are multiple contracts that are not combined, then one can only start offsetting items if other standards, such as the ones listed here, allow for that offsetting.
Manuel.
I think I agree with Brian. It seems that the standard is pretty clear and the answer seems easy. My question maybe is whether anyone expects changes compared to what is done currently.
So your point is it any different from what we've done in the past? Yeah. Henry, do you?
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, actually, it has been a frequent source of questioning at things like conferences, perhaps more just the issue, not so much the unit of account as the contract. I think the questions have been more about effectively the receivable and the, you know, as was explained in the paper, the extraction of the receivable from the contract balance. And that I think that is sometimes a little bit different about how people think about when they have a receivable compared to current practice in certain situations. And then the other question that, you know, has been raised a lot is about has been the offsetting of the contract asset and contract liability balances on different contracts. But I think in simple contractual situations, I would have thought that what the standard requires you to do is actually very consistent with what you would do for many sort of contracts today. And that's one of the things is sort of saying why the standard is very clear, to sort of say, look, you can describe these things using different language, you know, but we just use these sort of standard terms of contract assets, contract liability and receivables, but you know, so long as you explain the nature of your balances, you can use different terminology.
Quickly, I mean, but in principle, I was a bit wary about netting, but what's been described in terms of the separate, keeping the receivable separate, and actually not much change from existing practice seems fine. So I suppose my question would be, is there any chance that this could result in more offsetting, which might cause some concern because of opacity for users of accounts?
I think when you look at the you know, the last section of this paper and you think about when you would actually meet rights of offset, I wouldn't want anybody to get impression to sort of say that it would be frequent that you could be offsetting different balances. I think it's quite hard to think of the situations whereby you would meet offsetting requirements, you know, either in the contract or amongst different contracts.
Andrew.
Like others, we were very much where Brian articulated at the start. One point, though, that did come up in some of our discussions was that intuitively a number of people were looking initially to performance obligation level, because that's where the calculations are all done. And that is where a number of questions are coming up. Until you start talking to people and go into the basis and get to where the board was getting, which I suspect is to get a rather simplified balance sheet presentation and avoid a lot of clutter. On issue 2, very much into single contract, and issue 3, very much the same place. If it's permitted by other IFRSs, then offset. To the question of whether we would expect to see more offsetting, my initial take on it would be probably not. There might be a little bit of noise around the edges on whether contracts were combined or not, but I can't really think of many other circumstances where you might come up with something like that.
Okay, Tony.
I
agree with what everybody else has said, and I think the standard is perfectly clear about the union of account, what happens when you combine contracts, and what happens when you have a series of separate contracts and that you look to other standards. And there may be a layer of complexity, I think, as Brian and Mike described, once you take the next step and actually try to implement it. But I think the standard itself is perfectly clear and can be interpreted. There may be a perhaps an unusual outcome if you combine contracts with related parties and you're therefore offsetting balances between different entities. But again, I think the standard is clear, and that's perhaps a relatively rare situation. And if there is anything that comes out of that, then I think it would be disclosures that would address that. In terms of whether it's different to what we do today, I think the guidance in the new standard is clearer than what we currently have. I think there's anything that deals specifically in this level of granularity in IS 18 or IS 11 about exactly when you pull out receivables and exactly when you might offset. So I'm not sure whether it will cause any differences. I just think it is clearer than what we've had previously.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, over to you, Jim.
Comments? Jeff? I guess from a conceptual standpoint, I think that the right answer is probably at the contract level. I guess I have some concerns from an operational perspective. This, to me, indicates that entities manage their customer relationships on a contract by contract basis, and they bill specific to those contract terms. And I think that there can be certain circumstances whereby an entity for purposes of cash flow will deviate from the contract terms, look at all the contracts in totality with respect to that particular customer and bill them more at the aggregate level of all contracts and not specifically identify each billing to specific contracts. So whether that's going to cause some concerns, and I think that that can happen in a number of instances. It could be for the supplier managing its cash flows because the project may be larger than they ordinarily enter into. I think it also can be situations where the customer itself is shaky, if you will, and they want to make sure that they don't get out ahead of the customer and that they are billing and collecting on a timely basis. So I may be missing something within the context that covers that, but I can see that as a practical issue.
I think we in Canada came to the same conclusions as the rest of the group. Just a couple of additional comments to follow on Mike Zabel's comments. We did wonder if presentation of the assets and liabilities on a performance obligation basis was a reasonable way to go. It's not precluded in the standard. That doesn't necessarily mean it's allowed, but not precluded. And I think many companies will account for these contracts on a performance obligation basis rather than on a contractual basis. I think also that these three examples are relatively straightforward, and we are going to see some other practical issues arise. And I think of in the telecom industry where we bill a month in advance and then adjust those billings at the end of the month. There's no way today to attribute individual balances by customer back to any contract asset we might have on the books. So we are going to have some practical issues. So we may, this group may see more of those issues come forward.
I just wanted to hear if anybody here had reactions to the question about whether it'll change practice from today. I think I personally can envision at least one or two cases in my head, but I'm wondering if others who are closer to it would see it potentially as different, potentially as well.
Yeah, Mark.
I guess I was just going to, sorry, I don't mean to.
Which that wasn't.
Oh, sorry. We can't sit on the same row next time.
I have thought of a few things that will change. It's more of at the margins. For example, the receivable definition, I think, will, at least compared to what I see today, require some receivables to get recognized earlier. So today, if you haven't performed yet, there is an advanced payment due, but it hasn't been made yet. We typically wouldn't record the receivable in the contract liability. We'd wait for the cash. But I think today, or under the new guidance, that qualifies as a receivable that needs to be pulled out. It will require the recognition of a contract liability, even though payment hasn't been received yet. I don't think that's done today, most of the time.
Yeah, you're saying most of the time, because I think I've seen that done today. I've seen some diversity.
Absolutely.
It used to drive me crazy, frankly, when some companies did it and their peers didn't. But
right. So, today we think of that as, you know, do we gross up the balance sheet, you know, book deferred revenue and a receivable when nobody has actually yet performed? And, I think most of my clients conclude, I don't want to do that. I tell them I think you can, because I think the receivable meets the definition of a financial instrument, so you probably can do it, but most don't, whereas under the new guidance, I think it tells you you need to. So I think those kinds of things, there will be a change in practice, but I don't think it's going to be significant across the board.
Allison.
I would agree with Scott's observation about the receivable and deferred revenues and what could potentially be a difference today, but then also reacting or a follow-up comment on whether someone could present contract assets and liabilities at the performance obligation level. I guess we had read, using the FASB's references, paragraph 45-1, to suggest that you could not do that because it says that you present the contract as a that you would present either a contract asset or a contract liability, which suggests you have one or the other. Although perhaps, I think some earlier observations were made that for practical purposes, you may accumulate information about contract assets and liabilities at the performance obligation level. But I think we would have thought that once you got to the financial statement presentation level, that you really don't have a choice. You have to do it at the contract asset or liability balance based on paragraph 45-1.
Yeah, just one thing that I wanted to point out after Mark's question and what we heard from Scott Taub that was in the staff's thinking when we brought this issue forward is that Scott Taub is correct that there is, depending on certain industries, there's interpretive guidance, for example, that if you have pre-billed software PCS, you're okay to record your receivable and also record a deferred liability for the fact that you were gonna put that over time. But more importantly, I think the biggest reason why we seem to be getting questions about contract assets, even more so than contract liabilities, is because often contract assets don't exist today where they're going to exist tomorrow because of the contingent revenue cap in U.S. GAAP. I think telco is a perfect example of a scenario where, you know, be it handset sales under some of the older subsidy models and possible certain, you know, free service models where you're going to end up now with these contract assets that never existed before because they don't represent valid rights to consideration. They're not receivables yet at this point, but because the model no longer retains the contingent revenue cap, that's why these contract assets are now a thing that people have to deal with that is something of a new concept.
My view is that, contracts matter. And when we look at this transaction from the outside in, our customer in many cases is looking at the contract level and the mutations that we do internally about performance obligation is a downstream thing from the customer. And that customer is, when we deal with how they're going to deal with our entity, they're going to have rights of offset at the contract level in most cases. And the performance obligation means nothing once you get to the enforceability of the contract. So I see this almost as the same discussion that the boards went through in the early deliberation on this project when they were addressing the issue of onerous contracts and whether you would have an onerous position on a performance obligation or not. And I think the consensus was that it would be done at the contract level. And so I think performance obligation presentation should be at the contract level under the same concept.
Anyone else? Marty.
Just wanted to ask a question about this statement that an entity shall combine two or more contracts entered into at or near the same time with the same customer or related party of the customer. So if a telecom company is dealing with General Electric and General Electric has many multiple businesses, they could be a contract could be very, very, very near each other in terms of dates, but with two different segments of that business, and those contracts could be sort of highly unrelated. Is this suggesting still that those contracts would be treated as one contract? It wouldn't seem like it should be.
That's right. You'd have to meet one of the other criteria that kind of center around that notion, right, of having a single commercial objective or being part of a single performance obligation. So the mere fact that you've entered into a contract at or near the same time with two separate business units of an entity does not mean thou shalt combine unless you meet one of the other criteria.
Jim.
You know, if they're getting back to one of the questions that was raised, it's not one of the ones that is in the topic, but I think Allison made the point on the optionality of grossing up a contract or a performance obligation liability in an asset. And there were two views presented, and I would tend to agree with the one Allison made, but I was curious if the boards are of that view as well.
Recognizing I'm not a board member, but I'll speak anyway. Allison read directly from the standard, and I think what she read is point on that there's not an option. The standard tells you what you should do, absent, you know, the normal materiality considerations.
Go ahead.
I want to give a little history in terms of contract assets and liabilities to the standard. In some of the early exposure drafts, we talked actually about, in the books and records, starting out with recognizing all the rights under the contract as a separate contract asset, all the obligations under the contract as a contract liability, and then having those two things fully recognized, a net presentation. As our writing of the standard evolved, that sort of entries in books and records are no longer inherent in the standard. If you look at the general presentation guidance, it says if there's differential performance by one or two of the parties, the degree of differential performance causes a contract asset or a contract liability to emerge. And so it's not that necessarily that the way that's described is a full netting of all the rights and obligations in the contract. And that's why when we write the disclosure guidance to say the amount of transaction price allocated to remaining performance obligations, it's not talked about the contract liability. That is the accumulated amount of the performance obligations that remain. That would have been the original contract liability notion early in the standard that is no longer there. So while we talk about in presentation the basis of conclusions netting, it's not clear to me that there is in the basic books and records a notion of netting of those two leading to the development of contract assets or liabilities. It's just differential performance and the degree of differential performance.
Ian, barring any other cards here, I think we'll send the issue back to you.
Okay. No other further comments in London? I mean, I think I heard everybody really was in agreement with the paper and that the contract is the unit of account. There were some questions raised saying there would be practical difficulties in some circumstances. I don't think the normal circumstances would have practical difficulties, but there are some, and we may have some of those practical difficulties brought back to us, was another suggestion. And on the question of, is this likely to affect present practice much, I think the consensus was that, except at the margin, it wouldn't affect present practice much. So I think that's the way I'd sum it up. If anybody's got any comments on that, I'm happy to take them.
Okay. We have one here.
Okay.
I would like to just raise the issue that under the standard, we recognize a contract asset or liability, but there are other new contractual or assets that arise, for example, things like cost of performing an performing or of obtaining a contract, the notion of costs that are incurred that do not create performance under the contract can become assets on our financial statements in addition to the contract asset. And so one of the concerns that I have is that I may have an early cost that I can bill to the customer and get advance payment for that creates a contract liability, but that asset is another asset that goes on to my books, and the concern about how the nature of those assets are treated by the users of financial statements. In today's world, we would have netted those into one liability. When we gross them up, you could literally get into a situation from a credit analysis or a surety analysis that the liability is there, but they're not too sure that that asset has any value from a credit standpoint. And so my balance sheet analytics become very punitive to a company if you don't net those numbers. So I just want to tell you that is a consequence that I believe will come from not being able to offset other assets against the contract liability. I'm not sure it's the right answer or not. I'm going to tell you the answer is wrong. I'm just saying there are maybe some unintended consequences that this standard will create in the business community.
I'm not going to try to put Rita on the spot, but I didn't know if she had any response to that or thoughts.
I guess it's a trade-off between trying to be faithful to the concept versus abuses that may occur or, you will gross it up and you usually don't want to see that.
I'm wondering if it's not just an educational process. It's a new way of thinking about it, maybe perhaps a more consistent way of thinking about it, and any change causes you to go back and I'm thinking of the earnings models. Do I want to rejigger my earnings model if I'm an analyst following a particular industry? The numbers look differently. Maybe that's also a good thing in that it gets you out of some old way of thinking that really didn't have a lot of conceptual thought behind it and now forces you to think more about the economics of the transactions and the contracts with the customers.
My response to that, having interacted with some of the community already on this, is it's as opposed to changing their behavior, it very well could drive them to disregarding the standard because they don't want the consequence. And that's what I'm concerned about is rationalization away from the standard because it has an adverse impact to the company. I know it's why we have auditors.
Ian, did the users in London have a reaction to that?
I'm not sure. Why would users want to ignore something because it had a disadvantage to the company that they're trying to analyze and look at in a sort of objective, even skeptical
I'm
way?
I'm saying the company rationalizes, not the user.
Sorry, the company. Okay, so what we need to make sure is that the user can see that the company's trying to do that because it's not very helpful. which is what the standard's about, isn't it?
But the question is whether there are any circumstances under which other assets should be offset against contract assets and liabilities. And currently there are none.
I just go back to my original comment that where users tend to be a bit nervous about offsetting. I mean, I don't know the name of the person who described the history of this, which was that you'd actually have lay out all the obligations and lay out all the you'd lay out sort of the two sides of the gross transaction. Actually, sounded quite a nice way of thinking about it.
That was an idea not pursued many years ago. I mean, and it is true. I mean, the point I think Tom was making is that fundamentally, the contract asset and the contract liability is essentially, it's a net notion in the sense of it's the net of the overall rights and obligations that remain in the contract.
Yes.
So it's not like you're really offsetting anything. It's just that's how we're accounting for the contract.
The point being raised was way outside the contract.
Just one other point on disregarding the standard. I don't think that users actually far from users giving companies credit for that. That would be a demerit, I think. So I mean that and that's actually a much bigger subject to do with adjusted earnings.
Could I just check that I was understanding the point that was raised in response to your sum up? And sorry, it was hard for me to see who it was who I think it was John.
Yes.
John raising that. Were you talking about the point that Scott Taub was describing earlier about the change from current practice, whereby today, if you have a right to bill an amount but haven't delivered the service, you'd recognize a receivable, you'd gross up to recognize a receivable and then a contract liability because you have not performed, where today you might have no recognition until the cash comes in, that the standard would force you to gross up in that situation, and you were questioning whether it was helpful because the receivable would be pulled out so you could not offset against the contract liability. Is that the scenario that you were raising, that you thought companies would be tempted to disregard the requirements of the standard?
No, I'm looking at more at items like fulfillment costs that may be incurred on the front end of a contract that create not a receivable type asset, but a cost that the company has actually incurred. They have likely spent the money. They have billed the customer for that and been paid for it, but it doesn't constitute revenue yet under the measurement of revenue. And therefore, they have a contract liability on one hand for their future performance obligation, but all of the costs have been incurred. They have done that element, but it's going to be amortized into the job and recognized as revenue over the remaining life of the contract. And so that's the type of asset that I'm talking about.
Thanks for the clarification.
Sure.
I think John is raising an important point, though, that there are assets and liabilities that can be recognized associated with this contract with the customer, where other GAAP applies in terms of how the items are presented on the balance sheet. Much of the discussion today was about the specific guidance we have with contract assets and liabilities under the new standard, but John is highlighting that other areas of GAAP may apply for those items. And it would depend on the item, but something that I would broadly characterize as a deferred charge, so you incurred a cost, let's say there was a commission that you paid. I'm sure someone can point out a good example where I'm wrong, but offhand, I wouldn't think there'd be many cases where the right of offset exists there for something like that type of a deferred cost, in which case you would have the item presented as an asset or liability and not netted.
Oh, I would if I have one of the examples that was seen expressed in the construction industry as something like the mobilization that a company incurs in moving into a job, and advanced engineering that is done that is not yet performance. If there were a termination of that contract, in the majority of contracts I see, if the customer has billed, and they typically bill for that up front, and oftentimes are paid on a termination, they would be able to retain those dollars, and it would not be an offset. It would be offset in a contract in the example that I'm giving. And so, that, as opposed to, and I agree on a commission, I might not even pay that commission until some performance has been done. But I'm concerned about costs that are deferred that have been paid that under the contract, if there were a termination, I would be able to retain, that I can't offset that against the contract liability, because the contract liability is only there because of a measurement of revenue and not the economic reality of the relationship of the contracting parties.
So I understand it'll be potentially different from today. I would have thought users, if you give your explanation, even though the initial concern might be sort of how much credit do you give to the asset, you would think users would pretty quickly understand the nature of the asset and the nature of the liability.
Scott?
Just in the situation that John describes, I think outside of the construction industry, if that arose today, companies would separately recognize the asset and the deferred revenue, because the asset is related to costs incurred, the deferred revenue is related to the advance fee, and my certainly understanding of practice is those don't get netted. You separately have an asset related to the capitalized costs and a liability related to the deferred revenue. Most of the time, they're going to get amortized over the same period, so they'll hit the income statement consistently, but that they are currently grossed up. So I think the issue you described, as far as it being a change, arises only in the construction industry, where the guidance that exists today, at least in the U.S., is slam all the assets and liabilities together into one net number. So I think it's a particular to that industry that this will come up.
Okay. It's an interesting discussion. So I think that draws us to the end of that topic. We're about 10 minutes ahead of time. Jim, would you rather break now and come back at, say, 1 o'clock in half an hour, or would you like to push
on? I think so, because I don't think we could do justice to starting the next issue and then breaking.
Okay.